You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After two high school football players in Steubenville, Ohio, were accused of raping an intoxicated girl, online vigilantes demanded justice, and social media ended up playing a major role in the case and its coverage. Ariel Levy looks at the case and whether justice was served in an article called Trial by Twitter in the August 5th issue of The New Yorker, where she's a staff writer. I'm very pleased it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Thanks so much for having me.
There was a lot of misinformation about this case from the start. What are the facts of what really happened that night last August in Steubenville, Ohio?
Well, what really, really happened, we'll never know. The victim doesn't know. She sort of passed out intoxicated at some point during the evening and doesn't remember anything, didn't know that anything had happened until she woke up the next day and... You know, she woke up at the home of a classmate of a boy's with some other students, some boys and a girl, and didn't realize that anything had happened until she saw on Twitter later in the day people basically mocking her and calling her all sorts of horrible names, and there were pictures of her passed out and being carried around, and there were pictures of her naked. And that was when it became clear to her that something bad had happened.
Nothing physical? There was no physical thing that might have made her suspicious?
Absolutely not. No.
How old was she?
16. And her parents became aware of this, too. I mean, I think that it sort of rippled through the town on social media very quickly. And in the days right after these parties, which happened August 11th of last summer, the next day it started rippling through the town, and kids started tweeting about it. People were blaming her. Some people were blaming her, and football players, because those are the boys that she sort of fell asleep around were on the football team. And football's a very big deal in Steubenville. They've won 9 state championships since the 80s, I think since 1984, which is the year after the current coach, Reno Sakach, was hired. So football's a really big deal there, and so it was very controversial within the town that these football players were obviously involved in something. And when her parents became aware of what everyone was saying on Twitter, they went to the police, and it was up to the police then from these tweets to figure out who they should call in and start interviewing to try to ascertain what had happened. And to the best of our knowledge, what happened in court was that the two boys, Malik Richmond and Trent Mays, who were both 17, were found guilty of raping her. And it's worth mentioning, I think, that rape in Ohio includes what they kept calling throughout the trial digital penetration. So it's not that these kids had intercourse with her, but what they did do was penetrate her with their hands when she was too drunk to give consent. And that is considered rape in Ohio, and they were both found guilty.
Who had she gone to the party with, at least the first one?
She went to the party with a female friend. You know, she was staying right across the street from the first party with a female friend. And she went to the party, and she was texting with this boy, Trent Mays. And she quite clearly, I mean, through her own testimony and through what we can see on the tweet, she had a big crush on this kid. And the other reason we know that is that she, the first party, the boys, Trent and Malik and two other boys, went to go to a second party, and she wanted to go with them. And her friends tried to stop her, and she was yelling at them. And, I mean, she was so set on getting in the car with these boys, she actually became physically combative with her friends, according to the friends and according to witnesses who testified at the trial. So it's a very interesting case because, as her lawyer told me, if things had been different, you know, if Trent Mays had played this evening like a respectful young man engaged in a romantic relationship, he probably would have had a consensual physical encounter with this girl. But that's not what he did. You know, he did not wait till she was conscious. And that, of course, is not okay.
Now, isn't taking nude photographs of a minor also a crime?
It is.
In
and
Ohio?
That's why Trent Mays was sentenced to 2 years, and Malik Richmond was only sentenced to 1 year.
And they had taken the photographs?
Trent Mays took a picture of her naked, which he disseminated to all his friends the next day. And he got a year for that as well as a year for the rape. There were other boys there who also took pictures of her naked that night. And that's a crime. In fact, any underage person sending around a picture of an underage person, even if it's the underage person herself, anytime, you know, one of the boys at trial said he had lots of photographs of naked girls on his phone that they had sent him. By law, all those girls who sent him naked pictures themselves would be guilty of trafficking child pornography. But in any event, those boys weren't charged because the prosecution had to make a determination about whether it was more important to get their tested. Basically, they cut deals. Basically, the Mike DeWine, the attorney general, made a calculation that it was more important to get their testimony than it was to prosecute them.
Isn't Malik Richmond seen as the more sympathetic defendant in this case?
Absolutely, because, I mean, Trent Mays was tweeting horrible things about this girl the next day. So as the Jefferson County prosecutor, Jane Hanlon, was saying to me, you know, it's not just that in the heat of a drunken night fueled by some kind of mob mentality he was violating this girl. It's, you know, sober, the next day, the light comes up, and he still thinks that this is funny and that, you know, there's nothing wrong with disseminating trophies of the night and making fun of this girl in the cruelest possible terms. Malik Richmond didn't do that. So that helps a lot. I mean, it's a pretty low bar to say, you know, you're considered more sympathetic because you didn't publish digital trophies of a crime.
But haven't some people seen him as a scapegoat because he's black?
Yeah, I mean, a couple people have made that case. Royal Mayo, who's the head of the NAACP in Ohio, stood up in a town meeting a few nights after Malik Richmond was convicted and said that's all it was. And certainly Richmond's father, Nathaniel, you know, told me he thought his son was framed. And Malik Richmond, who I interviewed in prison, you know, said that his friend, that he did in fact have consensual physical relations with the girl, but that his friends had totally fabricated their take, you know, what they testified to in the trial, the sort of exact positioning of his body and the timing of it. He said they made that up. Whether or not there's any credibility to that, it seems unlikely. It seems that Malik Richmond faced a lot of hardships in his life because of socioeconomic status and because of racial prejudice, but I don't know that I don't personally believe that he was framed here.
How old were the boys? Were they tried as adults?
No. They were 17. The Jefferson County prosecutor, Jane Hanlon, who eventually recused herself from the case because her son went to school with them, she filed charges against them as adults. But then Judge Thomas Lipps, who tried the case, determined that they should be tried as juveniles.
My guest is Ariel Levy. Her article, Trial by Twitter, was in the August 5th issue of The New Yorker. A woman named Alexandra Goddard played a big role in the case. She got an awful lot of media attention. Who is she, and why did she get involved?
She used to live in Steubenville. She grew up in the area in a house with no running water in the bowels of West Virginia, she told me. And then, you know, moved around in the Ohio Valley and then lived in Steubenville for 5 years in her 30s. So she knew the town and she had friends there and she retained an interest in it even after she moved away. She heard from, I can't remember which member of her family, but she heard about two boys from Big Red, the name of the football team, being arrested for rape, and she became interested. As she said to me, she got nibby, which is Ohio Valley slang for nosy, and she started going through their Twitter accounts to see if anybody had posted anything about it, and indeed, they'd posted all sorts of things about it. So she called an old friend of hers who had been on the police and subsequently became a member of the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigations to tell him about what she found, and he didn't return the call. And she didn't feel that the police and the town and the system could be trusted to adequately protect this rape victim and prosecute football players. You know, she felt that the town would protect their football players at any cost. So she published all these tweets that she found on her blog, Printified. And a lot of people, now she never said, okay, I broke this case. I mean, people attributed that to her. So in fairness to her, that wasn't her making that up. That was others giving her credit for it. But in fact, the police already had all those tweets. You know, the family of the victim brought those into the police. I mean, there was nothing she had that the police didn't have. What she did was say, okay, this is going to become a public matter. And what she would say is that, well, it was already a public matter. These boys put all this on Twitter. That's public. That's open. Anyone can see it. And she's right about that. But she drew a lot of attention to this scenario and what the police would say when everyone after that piled on and said, you know, this was getting swept under the rug. They said, well, no, it's not getting swept under the rug. We've got an open investigation. And when you're involved in an investigation, you don't walk around announcing every piece of evidence you have. It inhibits your ability to solve a crime.
But then her tweets were noted by the online collective Anonymous, who started following her. Why were they attracted to what she was saying?
I think that, you know, I mean, Anonymous is this sort of vast, mysterious entity, right? And under one heading, this notion of Anonymous, you've got people who are serious hackers who are, you know, launching hacks against the U.S. government, the Turkish government, MasterCard, I mean, big, big targets. And then you have lots of other people who maybe don't have that level of capability, you know, in terms of hacking. And maybe my point is just that it's a lot of different people with a lot of different interests under that one big heading.
Well, did they see her as a whistleblower?
I think they saw her as a whistleblower. And I think the thing that unites everyone who does, you know, who launches a hacking attack under the heading of Anonymous, the thing that unites them is a concept that bureaucracies are creaky and often corrupt, and the only way you're going to get real justice is by going to the masses and saying, okay, through the power of the internet, we can present all this information to the public, and then there will be justice. And sometimes that works. I mean, I personally think that Zimmerman would never have been arrested in Florida had everyone on Twitter not started saying, this has to happen. This guy has to get arrested. I think that was a situation where pressure from Twitter, from social media, really did play a part in making the criminal justice system work. Here, the police had already arrested these football players before any of this stuff became public on Twitter. So I don't know that it's fair to say that Anonymous brought justice in this case. They brought more publicity by hacking into the Big Red football website and replacing it with a sort of scary, ominous video saying, you know, if all the football players don't come forward for who participated in this brutal gang rape, is what they said, which I don't think is an accurate characterization of what happened at all, which is not to say what happened isn't horrible. It just doesn't happen to be that particular thing. You know, it was the arrest had already been made. So what they did really was just throw gas on the fire.
My guess is Ari Levy, her article, Trial by Twitter, after high school football stars were accused of rape online, vigilantes demanded that justice be served, but was it, was in the August 5th issue of The New Yorker. We will continue our discussion after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ari Levy, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and her article, Trial by Twitter, was in the August 5th issue of The New Yorker. Did any of the kids who were at these parties report anything to the police or to their parents or anyone else?
No. I mean, it's possible that they spoke to their parents, and we don't know about that, and the parents, you know, didn't do anything about it. But none of them came to the police. The first information the police got was from the family of the victim. And I think that many of these kids had no idea. I mean, first of all, there were only five kids present at the scene of the assault, which is the basement of this kid Mark Cole's home.
Although there is this notion that there were dozens of kids there.
Yeah, and that's not accurate. I mean, there were dozens of kids at these parties, and there were dozens of kids who saw that this victim, at that point she wasn't a victim. At that point she was just a person, as we call her, the girl from West Virginia in the article. People were aware that she was intoxicated, but we're talking about a high school keg party with no parents there where everybody's playing beer pong. Lots of kids were intoxicated. So nobody, I don't think, thought anything of it except that she was really drunk. Then she ends up in Mark Cole's basement with these five guys. They see that she's incredibly drunk, and they testify that they see Trent Mays and Malik Richman having, I don't know what to call it, being sexual with her. They're not having actual intercourse, but they're certainly being sexual. I think that they were probably aware that what they were seeing was not really okay, but they genuinely, I think, didn't know that they were witnessing a crime. And I think that I think plenty of adults, too, would not have known before this case that digital penetration could be considered rape.
How much do you think of the furor had to do with the fact that these kids were football players? Because we read almost daily in the newspapers of football players being involved in one kind of criminal activity or another, including a member of the New England Patriots who is now in prison awaiting, prosecution for having committed some murders.
I think that this case certainly brings up, an important thing, and also in other cases that have happened very recently. I mean, there was a very similar case in Torrington, Connecticut this winter where you had football players accused of rape and then being saying that they were defended on Twitter kind of misses the point. The point is that the victims were shredded on Twitter and basically, accused of being sluts. And I think that is really problematic. I think that all these cases ought to make us think, okay, let's look at our football programs. Let's look at our sports programs in general. Let's look at high schools and get into a discussion about the way girls are treated and the way girls are viewed, the way female sexuality is viewed. I mean, I think that's a very important and real discussion.
Although in this case, there's no female sexuality. She was unconscious.
Well, she was unconscious, but she it's a complicated case because there's no question that she was unconscious and that those boys violated her and that they should be punished for that. There's no question about that. That's awful. But I think that it is the case that she was actively involved in this. They were, I just learned this. I didn't know this was a thing. Malik Richman explained this to me. She and Trent Mays were talking to each other, which just means they were tweeting. And I mean, they were doing what I would have called when I was a teenager flirting, except now they do it all online. And I think that, there's a way that we could have a discussion with young people about the way sexual relationships, romantic, intimate relationships get started and transpire. We can have those discussions without blaming the victim. To admit that she is a sexual person and that she was engaged in a flirtatious sexual relationship with Trent Mays, and as her lawyer said to me, in all likelihood there was going to be a consensual sexual relationship had he had the decency and the humanity to wait until she was conscious and then to do that in the spirit of romance and mutual respect instead of doing it in this horrible, degrading spirit of I'm going to get something from her, I'm going to take something from her. And that's what we call rape culture, this moral system in which boys and girls are taught that sex is something that males get or take from females, not something that people who are equals do together consensually. And that's a real thing. That's a real problem. That's something that I think we need to work on as a culture.
Twitter can be a sea of misinformation. Was it at all helpful for gathering evidence about the victim and the accused?
I mean, I think that had these boys not tweeted about it the next day, they would never have gotten in trouble. I think that had they just, sexually assaulted an unconscious girl and kept it to themselves, she wouldn't have, I mean, maybe there would have been rumors, but there wouldn't have been, it was very unlikely there would have been concrete, substantive evidence that something had happened. I mean, they really did hang themselves. As Alexandre Godard put it, you know, it's like you rob a bank and then go in and brag about it at the bar. I mean, that's what this amounts to.
Now, it's clear just from the comments that we see posted on our show's website and on other shows' website that people aren't often as polite online as they might be in person, and that people say things online that they probably wouldn't say to a room full of people. Was that evident in this case?
Oh, my God, yes. And not just with the kids. I mean, the adults in Steubenville were horrible to each other online. It was really ugly. People, you know, Alexandria Goddard and her former best friend, who had been a roommate in Steubenville, this woman, Connie Lula, who's married to a guy who's in the Bureau of Criminal Investigations, who, by the way, you know, he was the guy, Ed Lula, who went and picked up the evidence from the crime scene. So it's a very small town. Everybody's involved in an interesting web. But Alexandria Goddard and Connie Lula were horribly, horribly vicious with each other on Twitter. I mean, Connie Lula's mother went on Twitter and said that she hoped Alexandria Goddard and all of her friends died of AIDS. I mean, stuff like that, that it's just hard to imagine people saying to each other at the supermarket.
You spoke with a professor of law and computer science at Harvard about this. What did he tell you?
I mean, he basically said that, you know, he sees two groups of online vigilantes, those who are just sort of think they're the bloodhound gang, as he put it, like the people who are on Reddit after the Boston Marathons, like, you know, making accusations and sort of coming up with wild theories that turned out not to be true. And then other people who, and this is what I think Goddard would be filed under, who think that the authority is essentially corrupt, and that because of bias, because of values, like, for example, in this case, that, you know, she didn't believe that the police would take seriously rape and the violation of women, you know, then they feel that in order for there to be justice, they need to correct against that bias.
My guest is Ariel Levy. Her article, Trial by Twitter, is in the August 5th issue of The New Yorker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, she may have good reasons to feel that about authorities, Alexandra Goddard. There have been a number of examples of sexual assault cases being mishandled at major universities, and a number of those cases have involved athletes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think
And then the military, where people often have just been excused despite an awful lot of evidence that they've engaged in sexual assault.
Well, to me, I mean, the military is just the most upsetting example of rape culture that you could ever ask for. I mean, in this country anyway. I think that, you know, the vast number of women in the military, and some men, but certainly the huge majority are women who are sexually assaulted while they serve. I mean, it's horrifying. And the fact that the guy who was, you know, charged with, I don't remember his title, but the guy who was in charge of hearing complaints about sexual harassment was picked up for groping a woman in a parking lot this winter. I mean, it's just an incredibly upsetting situation. And I think I just can't imagine how awful it would be to be serving your country, to put yourself in harm's way, and to think that the men around you who are your comrades would sexually violate you. I mean, that's horrible enough. And then that if you would report it, no one would care. It's horrifying. And as Chuck Hagel recently said, you know, it presents this country with an actual national security problem, because what you have then is a situation where women are going to start to be reluctant to join the armed forces, perfectly rationally. And with a volunteer army that's 15% female, that's a real problem.
Well, today, Yale, there's a report about Yale having to contend with mishandling a number of cases. We're talking about one of the great universities. So is this simply a matter of disrespecting women, or institutions trying to protect themselves because airing their dirty laundry they think might hurt their images?
I think it's both. I mean, I do think that we have a major cultural problem with treating women as fully human and not, I mean, in a culture where you've got almost one in five women getting raped, you've got a problem. You've got a major problem, and that's what we have in America with sexual violence. I think that just because you have a culture where you've got a problem with sexual violence and you've got a problem with the way female sexuality is conceived, I don't think that means then that you should run roughshod over the facts and the specifics. And that's where I think I have a little bit of an axe to grind as an old school print media journalist who's been, you know, doing the kind of work I do for 15 years. I mean, I think that as we see newspapers falling away and jobs in print media falling away and the entire sort of concept of journalism as a real profession, as a real craft, as we see that sort of crumbling as bloggers sort of come in and say, well, let's democratize this. Anyone can just go online and tell you what they know. The thing is, there aren't the same kind of standards in place for bloggers. There's not the same kind of fact-checking. So I don't see that accuracy is valued in the same way. I think that it's things, you know, it's like a scenario that could be true is I mean, like that many, many bloggers sort of talked about, not just, no, this is not on Alexandria Goddard. There were lots of blogs out there saying that she was gang raped. She was, you know, the Steubenville case, that she was urinated on, that she was dragged around in the trunk of a car. And it's not just a blogosphere problem. Traditional media then repeated those rumors. I mean, you heard that stuff on television, and it happened not to be true. It could have been true in a culture where we have a big problem with sexual violence, but it wasn't true. And I think as a matter of journalism and as a matter then later of law, I think the specifics are real important. I don't think we should round it off to something that could have happened. I think we need to know exactly what happened.
But what do you think would have most likely have happened in this case if there was no Facebook, Twitter, texting, or YouTube?
Well, here's the thing, though. If there was no Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, the victim wouldn't have known that a crime happened in the first place. I mean, she might have heard rumors about it from her friends. But so it's not, in this case, it's you know, social media was where the crime got made known, even to the victim herself. And then social media was what was used to sort of blow it up from a crime to a local tragedy to an international scandal.
Well, the victim's name was made public in the mainstream media on CNN, Fox, MSNBC, despite the fact that she's a minor and this was a rape case.
That happen? I mean, I think that is really terrible.
And there are policies against that sort of thing. What was the reason given?
Well, I think, you know, what happened was they were broadcasting live these apologies that the boys made in court. And Trent Mayes said her name, and they broadcast them. I don't think that was intentional. But Anonymous, for example, in the interest of justice, posted one of the pre-trials, not the trial itself, the probable cause hearing, it was called. They published that online, and they did not redact her name. I mean, that to me was a really terrible oversight. I mean, how much justice are you doing a victim by publishing her name so that for the rest of her life, when an employer or college admissions official or whomever else Googles her name, Steubenville rape comes up?
So once somebody reveals the name of a victim, then it's fair game from then on?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it's fair game, but it's out there. There's no getting it back.
Just this week in England, a woman who suggested that Jane Austen be printed on the 10-pound note has been attacked on Twitter, threatened with violence and rape. What is it about Twitter that makes it a vehicle for hate in that way?
Well, I mean, I think people, you know, hated each other even before social media. I mean, I don't think that the internet is responsible for the evil in people. But I do think that it's an immediate, instantaneous medium, and I think that it's very easy to publish things or respond to things without having the time to think it through. And it's public. I do think teenagers in particular don't realize fully that it's not just the people you want who are going to see the picture you post of yourself in a bikini. It's everyone. It's the world. You know, that's the nature of of the internet.
Do you think that the attention the Steubenville case got has shined some light on the issue and perhaps even started a dialogue on sexual assault? Or does the way this conversation goes just distort it?
I think it's good that we're talking. I mean, I think both. I think it's good we're talking about it. But I do think that the facts, the so-called facts of the case, were so distorted when people began this discussion that it's hard to know. I mean, how productive is a conversation? I mean, it's like the talk when the Tawana Brawley case happened when I was a kid. You know, on the one hand, we start having a discussion about race and sexual violence. Well, that's good. But then we find out that we've got the facts all wrong. So how much light does that shine? I mean, I don't know. I don't know that it's the best forum for moving forward in a dialogue when you've got the facts all wrong.
Aria Levy is a staff writer for The New Yorker. A reporter-at-large article, Trial by Twitter, was in the August 5th issue of that magazine. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.